Well, thank you. The most important thing to know about me is that my wife is Canadian. And on July 1st, in our house in Princeton, New Jersey, somehow, you don't think of Canadians being chauvinists, but something happens when they cross the border. And she went and found a large Canadian flag and hung it outside our house, and then announced on July 2nd that she was going to leave it up there until after July 4th, so that nobody in the neighborhood had any doubt about our our national loyalty. I'm going to hit on some of the themes in this book. It's always has to be selective in a book that runs at this length. One of the entire chapters that I write about in Eunice, my wife thinks it's the strongest chapter, which I'm not going to talk about tonight, is on pornography. We're a pornified culture. The numbers are staggering. It's part of that whole process of turning human beings into commodities. And I was completely thrown by what's mainstreamed for porn because it's incredibly violent, and it's not simulated violence. I went to Las Vegas and interviewed a lot of these women who act in these movies, and they're popping handfuls of painkillers before they're on the set. They're completely black and blue by the time they finish. The first interview I had, the woman gave me this kind of thousand-yard stare and began speaking that monotone I know very well from having been a war correspondent as classic signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I begin the quote, the chapter begins with a quote by Andrea Dworkin, the great feminist, who says, the left can't have its politics and its horrors, too. The book is really at the core about how we have, in Carl Pugliani's words, ripped the sacred out of our lives, not only the natural environment, but that intrinsic quality of the sacred that is at the core of human life itself. In celebrity culture, we destroy what we worship. The commercial exploitation of Michael Jackson's death was orchestrated by the corporate forces that rendered Jackson insane. Jackson, robbed of his childhood and surrounded by vultures that preyed on his fears and weaknesses, was so consumed by self-loathing, he carved his African-American face into a Caucasian death mask. He hid his apparent pedophilia behind a Peter Pan illusion of eternal childhood. He could not disentangle his public and his private self. He became a commodity, a product, one to be sold, used, and manipulated. He was infected by the moral nihilism and personal disintegration that is at the core of corporate culture. And his fantasies of eternal youth, delusions of majesty, and desperate, disfiguring quests for physical transformation were an expression of our own yearning. Jackson was a reflection of us in the extreme. His memorial service, a variety show with a coffin, had an average of 31.1 million television viewers. It was the final episode of the long-running Michael Jackson series. The stories that enthrall us most are real-life stories. Early fame, wild success, and then a long, bizarre, and macabre emotional train wreck. O.J. Simpson offered a tamer version of the same plot, so does Britney Spears. Jackson, by the end, was heavily in debt, and had weathered a $22 million out-of-court settlement to Jordy Chandler, as well as 7 counts of child sexual abuse and 2 counts of administering an intoxicating agent in order to commit a felony. Jackson reflected back to us our physical and psychological disintegration, especially as many struggle with overwhelming debt, loss of status, and deep personal confusion. The lurid drama of Jackson's personal life meshed with the ongoing dramas on television, in movies, and the news. News thrives on these real-life stories, especially those involving celebrities. News reports on television are mini-dramas. They provide a star, a villain, a supporting cast, a good-looking host, and a dramatic and often unexpected ending. In Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury's novel about a future dystopia, people spend most of the day watching giant television screens that show endless scenes of police chases and criminal apprehensions. Life, Bradbury understood, once it was packaged, scripted, given a narrative, and filmed, became the most compelling form of entertainment. And Jackson was a great show. He deserved a great finale. Those who created Jackson's public persona and turned him into a piece of property, first as a child, and finally as a corpse, encased in a $15,000 golden casket, are the agents, publicists, marketing departments, promoters, scriptwriters, television and movie producers, advertisers, video technicians, photographers, bodyguards, recording executives, wardrobe consultants, fitness trainers, pollsters, public announcers, and television news personalities, who orchestrate the vast stage of celebrity for profit. They are the puppet masters. No one achieves celebrity status. No cultural illusion is swallowed as reality without these armies of cultural enablers and intermediaries. The producers at the Staples Center in Los Angeles made sure the 18,000 attendees and television audience and even the BBC devoted 3 hours to the tribute, watched a funeral that was turned into another maudlin form of uplifting popular entertainment. The memorial service for Jackson was a celebration of celebrity. There was the queasy sight of groups of children, including his own, singing over the coffin. Brooke Shields fighting back tears recalled how she and a 33-year-old Jackson, who always maintained that he was a straight male, broke into Elizabeth Taylor's room the night before her wedding because Michael was too excited to wait until morning to see the wedding gown. Shields and Jackson at Taylor's wedding then, quote, pretended to be the mother and father of Elizabeth Taylor. It sounds weird, Shields said, but we made it real. There were photo montages in which a shot of Michael Jackson shaking hands with Nelson Mandela was immediately followed by one of him with Kermit the Frog. Celebrity culture reduces all of the famous to the same level. Fame is its own denominator, and every anecdote told about Jackson seemed to confirm that when you spend your life as a celebrity, you have no idea who you are. And yet, we live in a culture where we measure our lives by these celebrities. We seek to be like them. We emulate their look and behavior. We escape the messiness of real life through the fantasy of their stardom. We too long to attract admiring audiences for our grand, ongoing life movie. We try to see ourselves moving through our life as a camera would see us, mindful of how we hold ourselves, how we dress, what we say. We invent movies that play inside our heads with us as stars. We wonder how an audience would react. Celebrity culture has taught us, almost unconsciously, to generate interior, personal screenplays. We have learned ways of speaking and thinking that grossly disfigure the way we relate to the world and those around us. Neil Gabler, who has written wisely about this, argues that celebrity culture is not a convergence of consumer culture and religion, so much as a hostile takeover of religion by consumer culture. Jackson desperately feared growing old. He believed he could manipulate race and gender. He transformed himself through surgery and perhaps female hormones from a brown-skinned African-American male to a chalk-faced androgynous figure with no clear sexual identity. And while he pushed these boundaries to the extreme, he only did what many do. There were 12 million cosmetic plastic surgery procedures performed last year in the United States. They were performed because in America, most human beings, rich and poor, famous and obscure, have been conditioned to view themselves as marketable commodities. They are objects, like consumer products. They have no intrinsic value. They must look fabulous and live on fabulous sets. They must remain young. They must achieve notoriety and money, or the illusion of it, to be a success. And it does not matter how they get there. The moral nihilism of this court culture licenses a dark voyeurism into other people's humiliation, pain, weakness, and betrayal. Education, building community, honesty, transparency, and sharing are qualities that will see you ridiculed and voted off any reality show. Fellow competitors for prize money and a chance for fleeting fame elect to disappear the unwanted. In the final credits of the reality show America's Next Top Model, a picture of the woman expelled during the episode vanishes from the group portrait on the screen. Those cast aside become, at least to the television audience, non-persons. Celebrities that can no longer generate publicity, good or bad, vanish. Life, these shows teach, is a brutal world of unadulterated competition and a constant quest for notoriety and attention. And our self-exaltation permits us to humiliate those who oppose us. Those who win are the best. Those who lose deserve to be erased. Those who fail, those who are deemed ugly or poor, are belittled and mocked. Human beings are used, betrayed, and discarded in a commodity culture, which is pretty much the story of Jackson's life. The cult of the self, which Jackson embodied, dominates our culture. This cult has within it the classic traits of psychopaths: superficial charm, grandiosity and self-importance, a need for constant stimulation, a penchant for lying, deception, and manipulation, and the incapacity for remorse or guilt. Jackson, from his phony marriages to the portraits of himself dressed as royalty, to his insatiable hunger for new toys, to his questionable relationship with young boys, had all these qualities. And this is also the ethic promoted by corporations. It is the ethic of unfettered capitalism. It is the misguided belief that personal style and personal advancement, mistaken for individualism, are the same as democratic equality. It is the celebration of image over substance. We have a right in the cult of the self to get whatever we desire. We can do anything, even belittle and destroy those around us, including our friends, to make money, to be happy, and to become famous. Once fame and wealth are achieved, they become their own justification, their own morality. How one gets there is irrelevant. And it is this perverted ethic that gave us Wall Street bankers and investment houses that willfully trashed the global economy, stole money from tens of millions of small shareholders who had bought stock in these corporations for retirement or college. And the heads of these corporations, like the winners on a reality television program who lied and manipulated others to succeed, have walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses and compensation. The ethic of Wall Street is the ethic of celebrity. But the tantalizing illusions offered by our commodity culture are vanishing as we barrel towards collapse. The ability of the corporate state to pacify consumers by extending credit and providing cheap manufactured goods is gone. The jobs we are shedding are not coming back, as Barack Obama's economic advisor Lawrence Summers tacitly acknowledges when he talks of a jobless recovery. The belief that democracy lies in the choice between competing brands and the freedom to accumulate vast sums of personal wealth at the expense of others has been exposed as a fraud. Freedom can no longer be conflated with the free market, and the travails of the poor are rapidly becoming the travails of the middle class, especially as unemployment insurance runs out in the United States. And class warfare, once buried under the happy illusion that we were all going to enter an age of prosperity with unfettered capitalism, is returning. How will we cope with our decline? Will we cling to the absurd dreams of imperial power and fantasies of a glorious tomorrow? Or will we responsibly face our stark new limitations? Will we heed those who are sober and rational, those who speak of a new simplicity and humility in an age of imperial as well as material decline? Or will we follow the demagogues and charlatans who rise up in moments of crisis to offer fantastic visions of new glory? Will we radically transform our system to one that protects the ordinary citizen and fosters the common good, that defies the corporate state, that dismantles empire? Or will we employ the brutality and technology of our internal security and surveillance apparatus to crush dissent and drive us into a new dark age? In his book, Democracy Incorporated, Sheldon Wolin, who taught political philosophy at Berkeley and later at Princeton, uses the phrase inverted totalitarianism to describe our political system. Inverted totalitarianism, unlike classical totalitarianism, does not revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. It purports to cherish democracy, patriotism, and electoral politics while manipulating internal levers to subvert and thwart democratic institutions. Political candidates are elected in popular votes, but are beholden to armies of corporate lobbyists in capitals who author the legislation and get the legislators to pass it. The corporate media controls nearly everything we read, watch, or hear, and imposes a bland uniformity of opinion. It diverts us with trivia and celebrity gossip. In classical totalitarian regimes, such as Nazi fascism or Soviet communism, economics was subordinate to politics. Under inverted totalitarianism, the reverse is true, Wolin writes. Economics dominates politics, and with that domination comes different forms of ruthlessness. The Obama brand offers us an image that appears radically individualistic and new. This image inoculates us from seeing that the old engines of corporate power and the vast military-industrial complex continue to plunder our country. Brand Obama is about being happy consumers. We are entertained, we feel hopeful, we like our president, we believe he is like us. But like all branded products spun out from the manipulative world of corporate advertising, we are being duped into doing and supporting a lot of things that are not in our interest. What, for all our faith and hope, has the Obama brand given us? His administration has spent, lent, or guaranteed $12.8 trillion in taxpayer dollars to Wall Street and insolvent banks in a doomed effort to reinflate the bubble economy, a tactic that at best forestalls catastrophe and will leave us broke in a time of profound crisis. Brand Obama has allocated nearly $1 trillion in defense-related spending and the continuation of the doomed imperial project in Iraq, where military planners now estimate that 70,000 troops will remain for the next 15 to 20 years. Brand Obama has expanded the war in Afghanistan, including the use of drones sent on cross-border bombing runs into Pakistan that have left over 700 civilians dead since Obama took office. And Brand Obama has refused to ease restrictions so workers can organize, and because of pressure from our for-profit healthcare industry, will not consider single-payer, not-for-profit healthcare for all Americans. And Brand Obama will not prosecute the Bush administration for war crimes, including the use of torture, and has refused to dismantle Bush's secrecy laws or restore habeas corpus. Corporations, which control our politics, no longer produce products that are different, but brands that are different. Brand Obama does not threaten the core of the corporate state anymore than did Brand George W. Bush. The Bush brand collapsed. We became immune to its studied folksiness. We saw through its artifice, and this is a common deflation in the world of advertising. So we have been given a new Obama brand with an exciting and faintly erotic appeal. Benetton and Calvin Klein were the precursors to the Obama brand, using ads to associate themselves with risque style and progressive politics. It gave their products an edge, but the goal, as with all brands, was to fool passive consumers that a brand is an experience. The decline of the American empire began long before the current economic meltdown or the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It began before the first Gulf War or Ronald Reagan. It began when we shifted, in the words of the historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. By the end of the Vietnam War, when the costs of the war ate away at Lyndon Johnson's great society, and domestic oil production began its steady, inexorable decline, we saw the United States transformed from one that primarily produced to one that primarily consumed. Americans started borrowing to maintain a lifestyle as well as an empire they could no longer afford, and they began to use force, especially in the Middle East, to feed an insatiable thirst for cheap oil. And the bill is now due. America's most dangerous enemies are not Islamic radicals, but those who sold the public the perverted ideology of free market capitalism and globalization. They have dynamited the foundations of society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in taxpayer subsidies. These corporate forces will never permit real reform. It would mean their extinction. The oil and gas industry will never allow us to achieve energy independence. That would devastate their profits. Real reform would wipe out tens of billions of dollars in weapons contracts and cripple the health of a host of private contractors, from Lockheed Martin to Northrop Grumman to Raytheon. It was Bill Clinton who led the Democratic Party to the corporate watering trough. Clinton argued that the party could ditch labor unions, no longer a source of votes or power, as a political ally. Workers, he insisted, would vote Democratic anyway. They had no choice. It was better, he argued, to take corporate money and do corporate bidding. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party, under Clinton's leadership, had virtual fundraising parity with the Republicans. Today, the Democrats get more. The legislation demanded by corporations, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, thrust a knife into the back of our working class. NAFTA was peddled by the Clinton White House as an opportunity to raise incomes and prosperity of the citizens of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA would also, we were told, staunch Mexican immigration into the United States. But NAFTA, which took effect in 1994, had the effect of reversing every one of Clinton's rosy predictions. Once the Mexican government lifted price supports on corn and beans grown by Mexican farmers. Those farmers had to compete against the huge agribusinesses in the United States. Many Mexican farmers were swiftly bankrupt. At least 2 million Mexican farmers have been driven off their land since 1994. And guess where many of them went? This desperate flight of poor Mexicans into the United States is now being exacerbated by large-scale factory closures along the border as manufacturers pack up and leave Mexico for the cut-rate embrace of China's totalitarian capitalism. But we were assured that goods would be cheaper, workers would be wealthier, everyone would be happier. I'm not sure how these contradictory things were supposed to happen, but in a soundbite society, reality no longer matters. NAFTA was great if you were a corporation. It was a disaster if you were a worker. And we in the United States are now getting a taste of Clinton's draconian welfare reform bill signed in 1996. As millions of people begin to lose their unemployment benefits and attempt to survive on $143 a month from welfare. It was the Clinton administration led by Summers which signed into law the Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999. The act ripped down the firewalls that had been established by the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act. And because your firewalls were not ripped down, Canada does not have a banking crisis. These firewalls were designed to prevent the kind of meltdown the United States is now undergoing. Glass-Steagall established the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It set in place banking reforms to stop speculators from hijacking the financial system. With Glass-Steagall demolished and the passage of NAFTA, the Democrats, led by Clinton, tumbled gleefully into bed with corporations and Wall Street speculators. And many of the architects of this deregulation, economists such as Summers, have come back again to service these corporations in the Obama White House. The cost of our empire of illusion is not being paid for by corporate titans. It is being paid for on the streets of our inner cities, in former manufacturing towns, and in depressed rural enclaves. Human beings are not commodities. They are not goods. Their misery is not the regrettable price of globalization and the free market. They grieve and suffer and feel despair. They raise children and struggle to maintain communities. The growing class divide is not understood, despite the glibness of many in the media, by complicated sets of statistics, lines on a graph that charts stocks, or the absurd utopian faith in unregulated globalization and complicated trade deals. It is understood in the eyes of a man or woman who is no longer making enough money to live with dignity and hope. The growing desperation sweeping across the United States is unleashing not simply a recession. We in the industrialized world have been in recession for many years now, but a depression unlike anything we have seen since the 1930s. It has provided a pool of broken people willing to work for low wages and to do without unions or benefits. And this is excellent news if you are a corporation. It is very bad news if you are a worker. For the bottom 90% of Americans' annual income has been on a slow, steady decline for 3 decades. And there are now 50 million Americans in real poverty and tens of millions of Americans in a category called near poverty. The assault on the American working class, an assault that is devastated members of my own family in the former mill towns in the state of Maine, shows no sign of abatement. In the past 3 years, nearly 1 in 5 U.S. workers was laid off. And among workers laid off from full-time work, roughly 1/4 were earning less than $40,000 a year. There are whole sections of the United States that now resemble the developing world. There has been a Weimarization of the American working class, and the assault on the middle class is underway. Anything that can be put on software, from finance to architecture to engineering, can and is being outsourced to workers in countries such as India or China, who accept pay a fraction of that of their Western counterparts and work without benefits. Washington has become our Versailles. Our media has evolved into a class of courtiers. Our political parties are populated by courtiers. Our pundits, academics, economists, and experts, at least those with public platforms, are courtiers, and we are captivated by the hollow stagecraft of political theater as we are ruthlessly stripped of power. The role of courtiers is always to parrot official propaganda. Courtiers do not defy the elite or question the structure of the corporate state, and these corporations in return employ them and promote them as celebrities or elected officials. Courtiers in face powder deceive us in the name of journalism. Courtiers in our political parties promise to look out for our interests and then pass bill after bill to further corporate fraud and abuse. But no class of courtiers, from the eunuchs behind the Manchus in the 19th century to the Baghdad caliphs in the Abbasid caliphate, has ever transformed itself into a responsible and socially productive class. Courtiers are hedonists of power. And being a courtier requires agility and eloquence. The most talented of them should be credited as persuasive actors. They entertain us. They make us feel good. They persuade us. They are our friends. They are the smiley faces of a corporate state that has hijacked power. And when these corporations make their iron demands, these courtiers drop to their knees. They placate telecommunications companies that want to be protected from lawsuits. They permit oil and gas corporations to rake in obscene profits and keep in place vast subsidies of corporate welfare doled out by the state. America is devolving into a state of neo-feudalism. And if we do not immediately halt our elite's rapacious looting of the public treasury and our bizarre state socialism for corporations, we will be left with trillions in debts which can never be repaid, and widespread human misery which we will be helpless to ameliorate. Our anemic democracy will be replaced with a robust national police state. The elite will withdraw into heavily guarded, gated communities where they will have access to security, goods, and services that cannot be afforded by the rest of us. Tens of millions of people, brutally controlled, will live in perpetual poverty, a state of neo-feudalism. This is the inevitable result of unchecked corporate capitalism. And the stimulus and bailout plans are not about saving us. They are about saving them. Franklin Delano Roosevelt recognized the danger of unregulated capitalism. He sent a message to Congress on April 29, 1938, titled, "Recommendations to the Congress to Curb Monopolies and the Concentration of Economic Power." In it, he wrote this: "The first truth is that the liberty of democracy is not safe. If the people tolerate the growth of power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. The second truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way to sustain an acceptable standard of living." The rise of the corporate state has grave political consequences, as we saw in Italy and Germany in the early part of the 20th century. Antitrust laws not only regulate and control the marketplace, they serve as bulwarks to protect democracy. And now that they are gone, Now that we have a state run by and on behalf of corporations, we must expect inevitable, and I fear terrifying, consequences. As the pressure mounts, as this despair and desperation reaches into larger and larger segments of the populace, the mechanisms of corporate and government control are being bolstered to prevent civil unrest and instability. The emergence of the corporate state always means the emergence of the security state. And this is why the Bush administration pushed through the Patriot Act and its renewal, the suspension of habeas corpus, the practice of extraordinary rendition, warrantless wiretapping on American citizens, and the refusal to ensure free and fair elections with verifiable ballot counting. The motive behind these measures is not to fight terrorism or to bolster national security. It is to seize and maintain internal control, and it is about control of us. In his book, The Great Transformation, written in 1944, Carl Polanyi laid out the devastating consequences, the depressions, wars, and totalitarianism that grow out of a so-called self-regulated free market. He grasped that fascism, like socialism, was rooted in a market society that refused to function. He warned that a financial system always devolved without heavy government control into a mafia capitalism and a mafia political system. All traditional standards and beliefs are shattered in a severe economic crisis. The moral order is turned upside down. The honest and industrious are wiped out, while the gangsters, profiteers, and speculators walk away with millions. A self-regulating market inevitably turns human beings and the natural environment into commodities, a situation that ensures the destruction of both society and the natural world. The free market's assumption that nature and human beings are objects whose worth is determined by the market allows each to be exploited for profit until exhaustion or collapse. A society that no longer recognizes that nature and human life have a sacred dimension, an intrinsic value beyond monetary value, commits collective suicide. Such societies cannibalize themselves until they die. And we face an environmental meltdown that is linked to our economic meltdown. Polar ice caps are melting, sea levels are rising, the planet is warming at an alarming rate, droughts are destroying croplands, and Russia's northern coastline has begun producing huge quantities of toxic methane gas. Scientists with the International Siberian Shelf Study described what they saw along the coastline recently as, quote, methane chimneys reaching from the sea floor to the ocean surface. Methane, locked in the permafrost of Arctic landmasses, is being released at an alarming rate as average Arctic temperatures rise. Methane is a greenhouse gas 25 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. The release of millions of tons of it will significantly alter the rate of global warming. The continued release of large quantities of methane, some scientists have warned, could actually asphyxiate the human species. But even in the face of this crisis, the oil and natural gas industry, along with the coal industry, have blunted any serious reform. Profit comes before the urgent task to save the ecosystem on which human life depends. Our working class, which has desperately borrowed money to stay afloat as real wages have dropped, now face years, probably decades, of stagnant or declining incomes without access to new credit. And the national treasury is being drained on behalf of speculative commercial interests. The government, the only institution citizens have that is big enough and perhaps powerful enough to protect their rights, is becoming weaker and increasingly unable to help those who are embarking on a period of profound deprivation. The United States, as a country, has been borrowing at the rate of more than $2 billion a day over the last 10 years. And at some point, this has to end. The moment China, the oil-rich states, and other international investors stop buying treasury bonds and walk away from the American dollar, which appears perhaps to be underway, inflation will rocket upward. We will become Weimar Germany, and a furious and sustained backlash by a betrayed and angry populace, one unprepared emotionally, intellectually, and psychologically for collapse, will sweep aside the Democrats and most of the Republicans. It was the economic collapse in Yugoslavia that gave us Slobodan Milosevic. It was the Weimar Republic that vomited up Adolf Hitler. And it was the breakdown in Tsarist Russia that opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks. A cobble of proto-fascist misfits, from Christian demagogues to loudmouth talk show hosts, who we naively dismiss as buffoons, will find a following with promises of revenge and moral renewal. And there are powerful corporate entities fearful of losing their wealth and influence arrayed against us. These anti-democratic forces, which will seek to make an alliance with the radical Christian right and other extremists, will use fear, chaos, the hatred for the ruling elites, the specter of left-wing dissent and terrorism to impose draconian controls to extinguish our democracy. And while they do it, they will be waving the American flag, chanting patriotic slogans, and promising law and order while they are clutching the Christian cross. Totalitarianism, George Orwell pointed out, is not so much an age of faith, but an age of schizophrenia. A society becomes totalitarian when its structure becomes flagrantly artificial, Orwell noted. That is, when its ruling class has lost its function, but succeeds in clinging to power by force or fraud. And force is soon all our elites will have left. Mass culture assures us, even in the midst of these catastrophes, that if we close our eyes, if we visualize what we want, if we have faith in ourselves, if we tell God that we believe in miracles, if we tap into our inner strength, if we grasp that we are truly exceptional, if we focus on happiness, our lives will be harmonious and complete. This cultural retreat into illusion, whether peddled by positive psychologists, Hollywood, or Christian preachers, is a form of magical thinking. It turns worthless mortgages and debt into wealth. It turns the destruction of our manufacturing base into an opportunity for growth. It turns alienation and anxiety into cheerful conformity. It turns a nation that wages illegal wars and administers offshore penal colonies where it openly practices torture into the greatest democracy on earth. It is time to fight back against corporate culture in small and large ways. Coalitions of environmental, anti-nuclear, anti-capitalist, sustainable agriculture, and anti-globalization forces are coalescing to form and support socialist parties. This has yet to happen in the United States. The left never rallied in significant numbers behind Cynthia McKinney or Ralph Nader, and this was our mistake. In picking the lesser of two evils, it threw its lot in with a Democratic Party that again has proven that it backs our imperial wars, empowers the national security state, does the bidding of corporations, and ignores the needs of citizens. If Obama does not end the flagrant theft of taxpayer funds by corporations and the abandonment of our working class, especially as foreclosures and unemployment mount, Many in the United States will turn in desperation to the far right, embodied by groups such as Christian radicals. The failure of progressives to offer a credible, democratic, socialist alternative, the only alternative that can now save our open society, to openly make war on corporate power, will mean that there will be in the eyes of many embittered and struggling, working and middle class people, no alternative but a perverted Christian fascism. I spent 2 years traveling the country to write a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. I visited former manufacturing towns where for many, the end of the world is no longer an abstraction. They have lost hope. Fear and instability have plunged the working class into profound personal and economic despair, and not surprisingly, into the arms of demagogues and charlatans of the radical Christian right who offer a belief in magic, miracles, and the fiction of a utopian Christian nation. And unless we rapidly re-enfranchise these dispossessed workers back into the economy, unless we give them hope, democracy is doomed. Democracies, as writers as ancient as Plutarch and Thucydides understood, cannot be sustained in oligarchic states. We forgot that social reform never comes from accommodating the power structure, but from frightening it. The Liberty Party, which in the United States fought slavery, the suffragists who battled for women's rights, the labor movement, the civil rights movements knew that the question was not, how do we get good people to rule? Most of those attracted to power are at best mediocrities and often venal. But how do we limit the damage the powerful do to us? These mass movements were the real engines of social reform, the correctives to our democracy, and the true protectors of the rights of citizens. We must, all of us, begin to opt out of the mainstream, to rebuild socialism as a viable political force. We must no longer be content with the crumbs tossed to us in the vain hope that we can influence the power elite from the inside. We must become as militant as those who seek our enslavement. If we remain passive, we will soon be engulfed by a ruthless totalitarian capitalism. If we remain passive, as we undergo the largest transference of wealth upwards in history, we will become serfs. If we fight back, we have a chance. The saturation coverage of Jackson's death was one of many examples of our collective flight into illusion. It deflected the moral questions arising from mounting social injustice, growing inequalities, failing imperial wars, economic collapse, and political corruption. As we sink into an economic morass, as we barrel towards a crisis that will create more misery than the Great Depression, we remain controlled, manipulated, and distracted by the celluloid shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. The fantasy of celebrity culture is not designed simply to entertain. It is designed to drain us emotionally, confuse us about our identity, blame ourselves for our predicament, condition us to chase illusions of impossible fame and happiness, and keep us from fighting back. And in the end, that is all the Jackson coverage was really about. Another tawdry and tasteless spectacle to divert a dying culture from the baying wolf at the gate. Thank you.